And welcome to your extended news at noon. Of course, we're going to continue this portion of our news with our news interview today. And on the phone with me is Mike Coulter. Mr. Mike Coulter, we've talked to him before. He is the chair of the professor of political science and humanities at Grove City College. And Mike, it's nice to talk to you again. Thanks for joining me for a few minutes.
It's great to be on today.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court seat. So I wish I could have you here all day, but we got about, 15, 20 minutes. We got to pack it in. It's a big conversation, as we know. And my first question about this is, why does this have to be rushed? Does it have to be rushed, or is this just a political grab?
Well, the Constitution doesn't specify how quickly this process can occur. It only says that the president nominates and adds people to the court to what we call Article III courts with the advice and consent of the Senate. So sometimes the Senates have rejected nominees outright with a vote. 2016 was a little unusual where there was just simply no vote or consideration held. Sometimes presidents nominate quickly, and sometimes they don't. Now, in recent decades, this has become a much more contentious and drawn-out process.
And can you explain 2016? For those of us who don't follow politics in and out, a lot of us are aware that no consideration was given. And that was for quite a few months. But why wasn't it even considered?
So, yeah, 2016 in some ways is quite unusual, is that so you have a Democratic president, and you have a Republican-controlled Senate led by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And 9 months prior to the election, Antonin Scalia passed away, and Mitch McConnell, within a very short time afterwards, said this is an election year. We should let the people have a decision in choosing this next nominee because it's so important. And he had cited a precedent saying that in some previous election years, nominations weren't made. But sometimes nominations were made and confirmed, and sometimes they weren't. So sort of some selective evidence from Mitch McConnell.
But just because some are approved and some are not, that 2016 didn't even get consideration, did it? I mean, there wasn't even
right.
a discussion.
There were no hearings on Merrick Garland. And no vote from the Senate. So that's really what makes 2016, particularly unusual, is there weren't even hearings on the case. And in some ways, people citing precedents from 100 years ago, I don't think are particularly helpful. I think there was a particular justice not considered a long time ago. Because nomination processes were much different in the 19th century compared to the late 20th and early 21st century.
Well, and to that point, though, let's fast forward to where we are today. When people are making that comparison between 2020 and 2016, that's only 4 years ago. I mean, we're not talking 100 years ago. And I think that's why some people are looking at what's potentially going to happen now. We have a feeling we know what's going to be happening down the road here in a few weeks. But if it does or it doesn't, we're only comparing to 4 years ago. And isn't that
right.
precedent?
Oh, yeah. That is, and what you have and what makes this case so interesting in some ways is you not only have this precedent from a short period ago, but you have a fair number of Republican members on who are still members of the U.S. Senate, like Lindsey Graham and others, Ted Cruz, who said, they shouldn't be considered. In fact, Lindsey Graham has this this very striking video that's been circulating this past week, saying, hold me to this with this video that a nominee shouldn't be considered if the primary process in a presidential election year has already begun. So you have that on tape, and then you have Democrats in 2016 who were saying we should nominate, and so people are sort of you have Republicans and current supporters of the president moving forward citing those Democrats in 2016. This is a very unusual circumstance.
And does this add to the frustration, no matter what side of the aisle you're on? Does it just add to the frustration of government and how it works, or some people would argue that it's not working?
Right. What it looks like is that people, and it's probably true in this sense, is that they don't have sort of accepted patterns of cooperation. You know, that's really what how political scientists would talk about this is, you know, if the accepted pattern is a president nominates and they at least get a hearing or potentially a vote, and then you change that to a new pattern, and then you change it back to an even, you know, then back to the old pattern, it makes it hard to cooperate. And even, like, legislative bodies need sort of patterns of cooperation that's beyond, you know, the explicit rules. And I'm sort of getting into the weeds of how, you know, political institutions work. But we kind of, I think for the most part, we forget about those unwritten rules that kind of guide the behavior of political bodies like a legislature. I'm not sure if that's...
No, it does. Helpful. And I didn't want to interrupt you because, you know, there are like 15 questions in my head that I'd like to ask you all of them. But that does get us off topic a little bit because I know we wanted to talk about the Supreme Court seat. But I will ask you this. In what I view, and I don't live politics day in and day out. That's why I appreciate talking to you to help me understand this. But what I see is that it feels like that Democrats stay on their side, Republicans stay on their side. Now, I'm not saying that that's in all cases, and I'm sure there are many cases that you could bring up to me and prove me wrong. But what my question is have we gotten to that point in our politics? It seems like years ago that you could be of a different party and still work with the other side.
Sure. And that's because there were probably some more modes of cooperation that made that, you know, that cross-party or cross-the-aisle interaction possible. And it's not just been this one thing, but truthfully, there have been a lot of things where, you know, Republicans distrust Democrats and vice versa, and they give up patterns. Like, so Republicans will say it's Democrats who poisoned the water on nominations because of how they treated Robert Bork in 1987, and Democrats will say, no, that was still within the bounds of, you know, standard behavior. So you have a lot of sort of arguing back and forth of the other side is at fault for poisoning the water to make cooperation possible.
So if McConnell does, I say, push this forward or allow this to go forward, I guess maybe a better term, and since the Republicans have the majority, if they end up confirming very quickly a nominee of whoever that would be, they're not breaking the rules, right? I mean, they're doing this legally.
Yeah, no, there's nothing that's unconstitutional or illegal about President Trump nominating, Senate having hearings, and the Senate having a vote and even confirming. The issue here is, like, about agreements about how, you know, sort of informal agreements about how we proceed. And again, it's hard for us to see sort of from the outside, but those informal agreements are really important to how legislative bodies work so that they understand, like, let's say every time there's a nomination, we get a consideration, or every time, you know, a nomination, you know, an opening appears in an election year, well, that waits. Yeah, I think there's this, you know, lack of, you know, there's no agreement about what that rule is right now in the Senate.
Yeah. Talk about, if you don't mind, how this particular nomination is different from the last two. And I just bring up the last two because they were both associated with Trump, you know, Trump nominating and that confirmation going through with Gorsuch and then Kavanaugh. So does this nomination have a big difference? Does it make, well, it makes a huge difference if it's an ultra-conservative.
Sure.
But can you talk about how this nomination, just the nomination, is a little different than the last two?
Well, this would be a very quick one. I forget the exact number of days it took for the Kavanaugh and Gorsuch nomination, but they won't be as quick if the president nominates or announces a nomination later this week, which is what has been signaled by the White House. And if the Senate starts a hearing even sometime next week or shortly thereafter, or the week after, this would be really unprecedented in terms of how quickly this occurs, because usually there's an attempt for the president to try to win over at least some members of the other party. And so there's some pre-hearing efforts by the nominee to talk with members of the other party. That's been typical. But I think this one, there'll be none of that. This will be just sort of, let's get the hearing started and try to, I would expect the Republicans to kind of get through these hearings as quickly as possible. So I would expect the Senate to use their, and it's a little harder in the Senate to do this, but to use the rules as much as possible to have a short hearing, so the hearing doesn't drag on.
Michael Coulter, he is the chair, professor of political science and humanities at Grove City College. We're talking about the Supreme Court seat. And I'm going to go back to my original question with you, Michael, is why does this have to be rushed? And I'll say it this way, because can't a nominee be nominated and the Senate take their time, even if a new president is elected into office, don't they still stick with the nominee that they are considering?
No, because this session of Congress expires on January 3rd, any nominees made during this two-year term of Congress would expire. So that would refer to either even a Supreme Court justice or someone to a district court or appellate court. So if this is going to happen, it's either going to happen, that is, if the president is going to nominate and have that individual approved, it would have to be either prior to the election or prior to early January.
Well, then, couldn't that be a scenario then? If Trump nominates an individual, couldn't they take their time over the next few weeks? Doesn't mean that they have to reach January. But yeah, even if the election goes Biden's way and not Trump's way, can't they still put into place a justice into the seat that has been nominated by Trump?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, so that's what many people think is the likely scenario, is that the vote will be held after the election. And so I think Mitt Romney's statement the other day that he thinks a vote should go forth this year. And that gives, in some ways, like if Trump wins, then they could vote on this nominee in November, December. I mean, I suspect even if Trump loses, Romney would vote for someone in November, December. But it could be that Susan Collins from Maine, for example, she does not want to vote, and neither does Lisa Murkowski of Alaska want to vote until after the election. And it's entirely possible that they would vote against a nominee because if Biden wins a big election. Like, they could say that that's what they're responding to, what the people want.
Can this have negative results for Republicans in the Senate if they push this forward and, let's say, a nominee is brought forth by the end of the week, as you mentioned, the White House has indicated that, and then let's say the process goes through, then the senators are going to be up for election at some point. That's how the government runs. So could there be any cost to them for what they're deciding now?
Sure. And the early polling, is just that. It's early, but this looks like it could really energize opponents of Cory Gardner, the Republican senator in Colorado, may even, further support for the Democratic candidate in Arizona, Mark Kelly. And so there's a few, and even for the Democratic opponent of Susan Collins in Maine. So the Republicans have a very slim majority, and sort of every seat is really crucial to maintaining their majority, after this 2020 election. So it's not unreasonable, and it's not a partisan position. It's just sort of an outside observer position to say that if this nomination is quite unpopular, let's say, or it energizes the Democratic base, it could end up contributing to the loss of a couple of Republican senators in November.
Do Democrats have any kind of play, any kind of move to counteract this?
Not really, in the sense of the filibuster is gone for judges. And so that would have previously, could have been used to stop a nominee to the Supreme Court.
And why is that important? Why is that important?
Well, filibusters, you would need 60 votes to stop debate, to invoke cloture. But that was a practice for a long time, but only used sparingly, and then it began to be used more. And actually, the Democrats helped change the rule when they had the majority to require only a majority of votes. And truthfully, probably according to the Constitution doesn't speak of the filibuster rule or the requiring a supermajority to stop debate. And that is sort of that using a filibuster sort of grew up over time to allow, you know, 40 members to halt things in the Senate. But so there's really not much in their procedural, you know, open to them from the rules or procedures of the Senate to kind of stop things.
So again, assuming that this goes forward, how do Democrats, what's their next play?
I think they've got, in one sense, they've got a short-term sort of, you might say, threat maybe is the wrong word, but short-term strategy, which is to really, you know, to energize their supporters in for Democrats running against Republicans for the Senate this year. And if a bunch of Republicans think they're going to lose because they vote for this nominee, then maybe they change their mind. So that's an electoral strategy. The other is the Democrats could say, well, if we win a majority of the Senate and hold the House and Joe Biden wins, then we're going to add members to the court. So we're going to take the court from 9 seats to 11 or 13. And then we'll get to add those members. And so that's the sort of, you know, what's now the sort of nuclear strategy. I mean, that would be a real shift in American politics. But again, the Constitution does not set the number of justices on the Supreme Court. That is set by law. So the Congress could change that number at any time, but they've stuck with 9 for about 150 years.
I'm not sure that I have enough information in front of me to give you an example, but I feel like I've been hearing, you know, throughout the last 4 years, like, this could be unconstitutional, this could be unconstitutional, and that phrase keeps coming about, but we seem to just keep barreling along. Is there, who stops all of that to check? You know, I mean, who stops to say, you know, wait a minute, this is not in the Constitution, or the Constitution says otherwise?
Right. Well, in this, we've had a lot of, this phrase has been used a lot in the last couple of years, and more publicly, but it's something that political scientists would talk about, is there really are these things we call norms that guide political behavior. So the idea of somebody wanting to change the number of people on the court would have violated a norm. Like, we should let the court stay very stable and not change it. So really, it's not as much, you know, the Constitution has very specific limitations in many instances. You know, the president, you know, can't simply nominate without the Senate approval. But we also have a lot of these norms which guide our political practices. And, you know, we could be entering this period where a lot of those former norms which guided behavior, and could be for good or ill, guided behavior, are just upset and rewritten. And that's the thing that makes, I will say, that makes political scientists nervous, because, you know, norms help give some stability to you know, political institutions.
When you talk about this upheaval, everything changing, I know you love what you do. I'm glad you love what you do, because I depend on people like you to help me figure all of this out. So my hat's off to you in this. But what's it like to be you right now? Because it feels like your world changes every 10 minutes, just as our world changes with news that we have to deliver. Is this confusing for you? Do you love trying to pick it apart? I mean, what's it like to be in political science right now?
Well, you know, for someone who, you know, studies and does some writing about American politics and political theory, on one level it's exciting, but, you know, some days, you know, what's the old saying of, like, you know, you hope you don't live in exciting times. I will say from a sort of professional standpoint, it gives us this great opportunity to talk about the Constitution, about political norms, right, to think about these things from a sort of personal and perspective as a citizen. I mean, I'll admit that this is a very worrying time. And one where, you know, I, as a sort of personal level, worry about, you know, the capacity for our institutions to stick together. I mean, to hold and keep working. I wish I could give less ominous sounding, you know, reflection on that.
And you're not the first to give that kind of thought. And the reason I say that is because, again, not living politics day in and day out, that's what makes me concerned. You know, when the professionals start to say, okay, we really need to pay attention to this. You know, we are living a historical moment. I think it makes the rest of us perk up and say, okay, can you explain that to me? And so it gets a little difficult when everything changes all the time.
Right. And I think that's the, that is the great concern. And we have, you know, the passions and the old sense of, like, you know, just being excited about this. You have both sides, you know, Trump supporters, Biden supporters, or however you want to call those sides, are as sort of, you know, intense as we've ever had. So we'll have great turnout in this election. Some of that great turnout is in part fueled by this kind of intensity of passion that's going on, and that can be good or bad, that intensity of passion. And I, I think our institutions and our political culture is durable enough, you know, to even get through difficult times. But, you know, we don't want to take things for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael Coulter, Chair and Professor of Political Science and Humanities at Grove City College. Thank you so much for your time. I'm sure we'll rely on your expertise many times throughout this process. But thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you. Have a great day.